Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and earned a B.S. in civil engineering from the University of Notre Dame and an M.B.A. and a Master of Public Policy from the University of Michigan. He joined DTE Energy in 1993 as Vice President of Non-Utility Business and was named its president in 2004. Since 2010, he's been its chairman and CEO. DTE supplies the electricity to 2.2 million customers and the natural gas to 1.3 million customers. His name, Jerry Anderson. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Pasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Jerry Anderson, the chairman and CEO of DTE Energy. Jerry, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, thank you. Honor to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, you know, when it comes to parents, I hit the lotto. I had awesome parents. My dad grew up on a farm, and that shaped his life. His father was a farmer first and then eventually founded what became a thriving business. But I'd say the work ethic that you learn on a farm shaped him, and also just the lack of pretense you get from doing hard physical work every day. And I think those were values that he passed down to all of his kids. My mom was an amazing woman. I lost her a couple years ago, so both my parents are gone now. But there was an older gentleman who kind of pursued my mom after my dad passed and told me at one point, he said, you know, I knew your mom at University of Michigan when she was there, and she was the prettiest woman on campus, but also the nicest. And, you know, that beauty made her sort of someone that all the young kids in the neighborhood, all the young boys at least, had a crush on. But it went a lot deeper than skin deep. At her funeral, somebody said to me, don't know that I've ever met a saint, but your mom is as close as I've come.
Wow. Terrific words. What's the biggest thing your mom taught you, Jerry?
Well, I think it probably is that you can accomplish great things in life through accumulation of small things. It's sort of that Mother Teresa, we don't need to do great things. We just need to do small things with great love. That was my mother. She touched so many people, but in big ways, by intercepting them at a time in their life when they really needed her. And so I had so many people tell me when she passed that your mom changed my life, or your mom caught me at just the right time and turned me around. A lot of those were invisible to me, but you know, her life had a big impact through all of those accumulated.
When you were a kid, were you a saint, or what were you like as a kid?
Well, I grew up as a young kid in a family of eight, so four brothers and four sisters in that order, which made my engineer dad very proud that it was all so orderly. But we were actually a small family in our neighborhood. The average family size was probably 10. So as a young kid, I grew up in a teeming sort of baby boom Catholic neighborhood, which was just great fun. It was an amazing way to grow up. I was a competitive young kid, loved sports, competed hard. I guess you sort of had to compete hard to maybe be noticed with that many young people around. But it was a wonderful childhood.
How was it you chose civil engineering as your major at Notre Dame?
I didn't go there to study engineering. I went there to study journalism. And the reason was the thing that had always come easiest to me in life was writing. And that's what people had told me I was good at. But I began to question my job prospects, and I had a brother studying engineering. And so I decided to jump in, even though I sort of thought that was the last thing I would do when I went there. Then I had a physics teacher who was an amazing teacher and just turned me on to understanding sort of the realities of the physical world. So I actually added a minor in physics to the engineering major, and I left Notre Dame with all this technical knowledge when I came in thinking, you know, that I'd be a writer.
You're a domer.
I am.
You either love Notre Dame or you hate Notre Dame. What makes the place so special?
Well, special for me is all of the things in my life that are threaded through that university. So I went there with my brother, and we spent 3 years together there. Two sisters followed us. I married a woman who went to Notre Dame. Her father, my father-in-law, is a Notre Dame graduate. And two of my sons have now graduated from Notre Dame. So I've had lots of reasons to be on that campus for important events across my life. And it's been an important part of my life for sure. You know, the other thing I would say that's a common thread for a lot of people who spend time at Notre Dame is the quality of the people that you meet there. I just say the people are as solid gold as that dome is.
Speaking of solid gold, the iconic president for 25 years, Father Theodore Hesburgh. Did you ever meet Father Ted?
Absolutely. Father Ted, as you probably know, walked the campus regularly. I probably remember best, I was a rector's assistant, an RA, and Father Ted came in for just a sit-down and discussion with a small group of us and sat and talked and listened. And I had just done some world traveling at the time, so he kind of bore in and listened to my stories of traveling around the world. He was a great leader.
He said that courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is action in the face of fear. He was an unbelievable person.
Yeah, great man.
In the mid-'80s, you worked for an economic forecasting group. What did that job consist of?
Well, I was in graduate school at the time, and that was the research seminar in quantitative economics. And that job consisted of me living inside models that literally consisted of thousands of equations that attempted to model the national economy and forecast it and do the same for the state economy. And so it was a highly quantitative set of work, but it sort of imbued me with a feel and an understanding of the economy that I don't think I would have come by without having been through that intense experience.
We're talking to Gerry Anderson. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the chapter of his life with McKinsey & Company, arguably the creme de la creme of consulting companies. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Gerry Anderson. From 1988 to 1993, he was a senior consultant at McKinsey & Company with a focus on the energy sector and financial institutions. Gerry, talk about that chapter of your life.
That chapter of my life was a bit of an accident. I got a letter from McKinsey when I was in grad school. I thought I was going to work in the public sector. And it was my roommate who knew who McKinsey was. I didn't know who McKinsey & Company even was at the time. And I said, I think I'm going to skip the interview because I'm going to end up working in the public sector somewhere. And he told me, absolutely not. You take that interview. That's an interesting company. And I did. And, of course, I worked there for 5 years. And it was a wonderful and intense learning experience. I mean, long hours, heavy travel, but essentially a postgraduate degree in business, and was incredibly valuable for me in the roles that I've played since.
How was it you joined DTE in 1993?
That was an accident, too.
You being here today was an accident, too, right, Dan?
You know, when I left McKinsey, began to look for the next job, and got a call from DTE, whether I'd come and interview to see if there was something of mutual interest. And I told them that I would, but I was about to get married, and that I'd do the interview after my honeymoon. So we got married. My wife and I went off for 3 weeks. I came back incredibly relaxed and not thinking much about work at all. And I was sitting around with my wife at dinner one night, sharing a bottle of wine and some good food, and she said to me, you know, you have that interview with DTE in a few days. And I said to her, oh, I was so relaxed that I just didn't really want to think about work. And I said to her, you know, I think I'm going to skip. And she said, Jerry, that would just be incredibly rude. Said, I know there are people who shifted their schedules to make room for this interview. You can't skip. And I said, well, I just don't think there's going to be something that they have that I'm interested in. I think it'll be a waste of time. And she said, well, then don't waste your time or theirs. Just go tell them what you are interested in. And I thought, that's really good advice from my wife. And so I did go do the interview and told them I'm interested in coming to an energy company and starting up new businesses. And they said to me, as luck would have it, that's exactly what we need. So I landed at DTE in 1993.
All right, let's jump ahead 10 years. Let's go back to August 14th, 2003. Where were you?
The Great Blackout. I was on the west side of the state. We have a cottage in Grand Haven. The west side avoided the blackout. I was actually coming back in to the cottage from a round of golf with a friend. We were coming back, hopefully, to watch the PGA tournament. And our wife and kids were gone, so we sat down to watch golf. And I turned it on, and there on the screen was headlines about a northeast blackout. Northeast to me means New York and Boston and places like that. But I told my friend that we got a hold on the golf. I need to watch this. And it was Ted Koppel. And Ted Koppel was talking about people leaving Manhattan and so forth, and then stopped at a certain point and said, wait, we may have just reached someone who actually knows what's happening here. Tony Early of DTE Energy. And I thought, why on earth is he talking to Tony about a northeast blackout? And Koppel said, first, Mr. Early, tell us about your system, at which point I learned we'd lost all our customers, and I just went ashen white and pretty quickly thereafter raced back to help with the recovery.
What happened?
Well, you know, the whole event was kicked off by a transmission failure in Ohio, where when that transmission line into Ohio failed, physics is physics. That state needed electric supply, and it sucked electricity from everywhere that it could find it, including Michigan and much of the Northeast. And it caused a big voltage reversal in Michigan, which shut the grid down. Our power plants came to a lurching stop, and many of them were damaged pretty fundamentally in that event. And, of course, the whole state went black. And our frontline people then went to work to recover all of that. And I learned a tremendous respect for the skills and work of our frontline people through that event. It was amazing to me how they could go into darkened facilities with unknown damage and filter through all of that and put those big complex machines back online in relatively short order and slowly pull our state back from darkness to working again.
You mentioned Ted Koppel reached out to Tony Early, our mutual friend, great man, a double domer.
Yes, indeed.
Right? Yeah. Married Sarah.
Yeah.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Tony Early in those 3 days, Jerry?
Not to shrink from a crisis. Some leaders in a crisis retreat. They step back, maybe even hide. What I saw Tony do during that crisis was step forward into the light and communicate clearly and be a front for his people. And good leaders do that.
Speaking of stepping forward, not hiding, in 2010, how was it you were selected to be chairman and CEO of DTE Energy?
Well, you know, 2010 was the heart of the economic crisis, and it turns out I had actually been selected in 2008. Tony and the board and I had talked about the transition, so I knew it was coming. But as 2008 and 2009 unfolded, I realized that I was going to assume the mantle right in the middle of a massive meltdown with Detroit at the epicenter of a world crisis. So it was quite an introduction to being CEO at DTE.
Tell us about DTE.
You know, most people think of us as the energy company which supplies much of Michigan with its electricity and gas, which is certainly true. What most people don't know is that about 30% of our business now is outside of Michigan in 25 other states. We've grown companies, energy-related companies, elsewhere in the United States. I think about DTE as the 11,000 people who make it up, and I'll just say we have an amazing workforce at DTE. I'm really proud of our people.
We've just had the NFL draft. And a lot of offensive linemen were drafted. I've often thought that DTE is like an offensive lineman or a referee. It's never good when you hear the name of a referee or an offensive lineman. Same way with DTE.
Well, I guess if DTE is an offensive lineman, I want them to be Quentin Nelson, that guy picked from Notre Dame who actually does get picked out a lot because he does his job really well. Look, you're right, in some circumstances you don't want to hear DTE's name, outages or things like that. But in other places I do want us to be front and center. So I want us to be front and center in leading the charge toward cleaner energy. I want us to be visible and talked about for what we're doing in our communities. And so I think a company like mine, if they're doing their job right, should be heard about in some ways for positive steps.
We're talking to Jerry Anderson, the chairman and CEO of DTE Energy. When we come back, we're going to ask him about those 11,000 teammates. And I'm Jack Rasool. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Jerry Anderson. Jerry, talk to us about the ministry of your 11,000 teammates.
You know, ministry is a really interesting and actually a great way to talk about a leader's relationship with employees. So, yes, I have about 11,000 people at DT, an amazing group of people. So why do I say that? Well, I put a lot of time and energy into where the heads and hearts of our people are, because I think ultimately for a company to be great, its people need to be willing to give what I call discretionary energy, meaning energy that they might normally reserve for their church or their family or other things that they really care about or love. But if a company's worthy of that, they'll give it to a company too. But if a company's not, they won't. So I think it makes all the difference for a company's performance whether people are willing to give that discretionary energy. There's a group called Gallup. They do polling for political purposes. They also measure where people's heads and hearts are in companies. They call it an engagement survey, but that's really what it is. There was a time we were not proud of our results, generally fell in the bottom 20%. In our most recent survey, we were in the top 3% of Gallup's worldwide database. They look at hundreds of companies all over the globe. In fact, we just won our 7th great Gallup Great Workplace. So in their long history of doing this, there's only 10 other companies that have ever won 7 straight. And I think what it says is that the people of DTE are connected to our company and its purpose.
What's changed?
Well, what had to change first was the way we led. You know, one thing you can say about people who maybe don't have their head and heart in a company is, what's wrong with our people? But that's usually not the case. I think the first question to ask is, what's wrong with the way we're leading our people? And so we had to change the shadow we cast. I had a board member, a guy named Joe Robles. Joe led USAA, the company that, great company, that serves members of the military and their families and former members of the military. I went to visit Joe at his operations in Texas, and we got into a conversation. And Joe said something to me that I'll never forget. Joe said, Jerry, the first job of a leader is to connect his people to purpose. And as a CEO, that's your job. And he said that because we had just walked through his call center operation where people were picking up phones and answering calls, but I said to him, your people were so energized and happy. How do you produce that? And he said, Jerry, I connect them to what they're really doing. He said, now look, the person on the other end of the line may be rude or impatient, but they may also be somebody who served this country or are doing that right now, or they may be their spouse. And it's my job to remind them just how important what we do is every day. And so they do their work with that spirit. And that night, as I flew home, I thought, you know, our work is equally important. We've got a really important role that we play at DT, and we need to connect our people to that.
Let's talk about the linemen. Let's go back to January 10th or so, when that unbelievable cold spell hit. What, 15 below, you know,
yep.
Couple mornings, the wind chill, major storm hits, and these linemen are up there on them poles. Talk about the job they do in the worst of conditions.
Our linemen go out there in the ugliest of weather to bring the essentials back to the community. And it is tough work. But I got to tell you, when our linemen are in the midst of conditions like that, it's perhaps when they feel our purpose most clearly, because they know that the community today depends on electricity as its lifeblood. And when people are without it, life stops, literally. And so for them, the ability to play a role, regardless of conditions, to put life back to being right for people is really meaningful.
2008, the economic tsunami hits. DTE loses $200 million in revenue. Top line, it evaporated almost overnight.
Yep.
How did you lead the team through that?
Why I remember those events like they were yesterday. So in late 2008, when the stilts started to come out from under the world economy, we'd spent most of the year building a plan for 2009. And I remember saying to our team, that's all rubbish, means nothing. We've had a lot of money walk out the door. And this was about Thanksgiving of 2008. And I said to the team, let's go home and enjoy Thanksgiving. And when we come back, we've got 10 days to put together a plan that figures out what to do, because $200 million have walked out the door. We were being called potentially the first junk bond utility as a result, that we were going to be thrown on the scrap heap of Michigan companies. Well, about 2 days into that planning, that 10-day planning process, two of my senior leaders came back and said, there's just no way to do it without a big layoff. We need to lay off about 20% of our workforce. And I knew I was facing the decision of my career. Because if I walked away from our people at their moment of greatest fear and exposure, that would define their culture, our culture, really, and their understanding of me for many years to come. So I called our team back together, and we jointly decided we can't do that. In fact, we're going to do the opposite. So in late 2010, I recorded a message to our people that said, look, this is huge what's hit us. I don't know that I can make any promises, but I'll make you this one promise. The last thing we will do to stay healthy is to lay anybody in this company off. But for me to make good on that promise, I need a promise from you. I need you to come at improving this company with more energy, more focus, and more creativity than you ever have before. And if all 10,000 of us do that, I think we have a chance to come through this sound. So that was our plan.
Share with us, Jerry, your leadership style.
Well, that event that I just described shaped my leadership style, because what I experienced in 2009 and beyond was sort of unbelievable to me. Month after month, my controller came back to me and said, we beat our budget. At a certain point, I said to him, there's something wrong with your financial model. This doesn't make sense with GM heading into bankruptcy and steel mills closing. How can we be beating our budget? I remember at a certain point slamming the table after about the eighth month of him telling us we'd beat our budget and saying, your model's broken. Figure out what's wrong. And he slammed the table and said, it's not. It's just what's happening. And what I learned was the amazing things people are capable of if they're truly committed to a cause. And it shifted my leadership style. I was brought up on the hard side. I was brought up through engineering and physics and economics and finance and problem solving and strategy. Those are the things I capitalized on as I came up through DTE. But what I learned in the economic crisis is that it really is the first job of a leader to connect their people to the purpose in their work. And when you do that, the results can be completely unpredictable, like they were for me in 2009. I remember telling the board at the end of 2009, I have learned more in this year than I have in any other year of my career by a wide margin. And everything I've learned is about people and what they are capable of when they really believe in something.
We're talking to Jerry Anderson. If you want to learn more, www.dteenergy.com. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Jerry Anderson, chairman and CEO and servant leader of DTE Energy, of which you do a great job of that, Jerry, every day.
Thank you.
Another servant leader was Gene Miller, the iconic chairman of Comerica that started in the mailroom at Detroit Bank and Trust. So I asked him, 19 years ago, to write his philosophy of life. And he said, 20 years ago, somebody asked me, Jack, what does CEO stand for? I said, of course, chief executive officer. The man said, that's the answer I get 99% of the time. He said, but Gene, C really stands for the customer, E stands for the employee, and O stands for the owner. Your thoughts?
Gene is a great man and a great friend. Gene was a member of our board for years, and having somebody like him to advise was invaluable. Gene was if I had to pick out somebody on our board over the years who was particularly important as a counselor to me, Gene has to be at the top of that list. When I became a new CEO, he pulled me aside, gave me very practical advice. One of the things he told me is, Jerry, you're now in a position where it's going to be harder for you to hear from your people, harder for you to connect from your people. So find an easy way to find people from all over the company and sit them down and talk to them. And I thought of that advice and said, it's very sage, and did that. Started having breakfast with a dozen employees every month, and I've done it for really the past 15 years. And I can't tell you how many insights about the company and decisions that I need to make came out of those breakfast meetings with employees from the front line of power plants up through maybe supervisor of a mail room. Gene was exactly right.
This industry that you're in is the lifeblood of our economy. Let's talk about natural gas. We can't see it. Jerry, what is it?
Yeah, a lot of people aren't sure what the difference between gasoline and natural gas is. So natural gas, as you said, is not a liquid. It's a gas. It's what comes out of your stove, if you have a gas stove, or what most people use in their furnace. It's produced by drilling to formations underground. And interestingly, is something that this country thought it was running out of only 10 years ago, and now has amazing, plentiful quantities of. And a lot of that came at the right time because it's a very clean and much lower carbon fuel than coal. So in the movement to cleaner sources of energy, natural gas is playing a very important transitional role.
And I believe Michigan has more reserves of natural gas than any other state in the union.
Actually, more storage than any other state. So that's just a fate of geology. We have these amazing ancient reef formations from hundreds of millions of years ago underneath our state that allows us to store billions and billions of cubic feet of natural gas, not only for our use here in Michigan, but we ship natural gas during peak periods like that polar vortex. We were shipping gas to New York and Boston and a whole lot of other places because of those huge natural gas storage formations.
A number of weeks ago, D Business had an article entitled Detroit's DTE Energy Plans to Reduce Carbon Emissions by 80% by 2040. That's only 21 years away.
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple of years ago, the Clean Power Plan that the EPA had developed was set aside, and You know, I was getting a lot of questions asked about, you know, are we going to go backwards as a company? What's going to happen environmentally? And we decided back in 2017 that it was just time to make our plans clear. So we at that point committed that we were going to reduce carbon 80% by 2050. And we're one of the first energy companies in the nation, if not the first at that point, to make a commitment like that. Just recently, we updated that commitment, and you're right, 80% by 2040 and 50% down by 2030. What that will require is significant investments in renewable energy, and we're doing that. And also investments in clean natural gas generation in order to preserve reliability as we transition away from coal.
Talk to us about nuclear.
Well, nuclear today is about 20% of the nation's supply, and of course it's zero carbon. So renewable energy today supplies about 10% of the nation's energy. So if you think about zero carbon energy, which is getting a lot of focus these days, today nuclear is an incredibly important source of that. And so we need to preserve the existing nuclear, I believe, and over time find a more economical way to add new nuclear.
Talk to us about solar power.
10 years ago, solar power looked expensive enough that it was just hard to include in your mix. That has changed radically. We are seeing solar power just become more and more competitive. In Michigan today, wind is still the cheapest renewable resource, but solar is gaining ground fast. So our plan is to invest a couple billion dollars in additional wind resources over the next 5 years. But I think around 2024, 2025, we'll see a flip in Michigan, certainly in our plans, to solar, because we see the economics being there at that point. It's going to be a great resource.
You're also the chairman of the Detroit Economic Club. Since 2017. Tell us about the Detroit Economic Club.
You know, Bill Ford approached me to take that over and said to me, Jerry, I've been at this a long time. It's time for me to step down, but this is a really important institution. He's right. The Detroit Economic Club brings in speakers from all over the country and all over the world to share their insights with the people of Michigan and the people of Detroit. But at the same time, those leaders are exposed to what's happening here, to the recovery underway, to the resurgence, and they take that message back out to the world. And so as I listened to Bill, I understood he's right, and I'm really happy to play the role leading that organization.
You're also on the board of the Henry Ford, Patricia Meridian, who was a guest, Dan, about 3-4 months ago. Tell us about the Henry Ford.
Great organization. Patricia's a great leader. The Henry Ford is a wonderful organization. Of course, its long legacy is tied to innovation. First, the innovation of Henry Ford and Thomas Edison and many other inventors. But the real mission of the Henry Ford today is to continue to encourage that spirit of innovation in our young people. They've got a great board, a great leader, and that institution just continues to find creative ways to carry their mission forward.
In 2018... you led a CEO group that emerged as a force on transit, economic development, and other regional issues. So 20 corporations and foundational leaders. What can you share about that initiative?
You know, a handful of years back, I began to observe that there were great things happening in Detroit, but there was nowhere that the leaders, the most senior leaders of our region's largest corporations came together to back that recovery. We lacked that. And so I began to talk to leaders of organizations like Ford and GM and Penske and Blue Cross and the Illich family about putting together the most senior business leaders and foundation leaders for a civic mission. We were clear, this wasn't about business. It was about promoting the civic agenda, improving the city, improving the region. In fact, I had one of the CEOs say, if this is about our businesses, I'm out. I want to be in to help Detroit and to help the Detroit region. Incredibly engaged group. We're working on things like youth employment, education. So we've grabbed career and technical education and are helping to revitalize that within the Detroit schools. Workforce development, economic development, regional transit, as you mentioned. All of these are causes that we're working. And I love working with a group because they are really serious about putting the weight of their institutions behind these causes.
All right, following up on the great things being done in Detroit, as you just said, we hear so much about Danny Gilbert, the Illich family. What, if anything, has DTE done to help Detroit?
Well, first, it's great. I think we hear about Gilbert and Illich because they're doing a lot. I really admire the investments that they're making in the future of the city. But thinking about scale of investments, DTE invests $2.5 to $3 billion a year in Michigan. So if you look around, that makes us by far the largest investor in Michigan year in and year out. There's not another company, GM, Ford, or the others that are really close. And that gives us a platform to shape our communities that's really powerful. A number of years back in 2010, Governor Snyder approached me and said, "You spend more money in this state than anybody. Can you help by buying more from Michigan suppliers?" We really needed it back then. And we went to work on that. In 2010, we bought $450 million from Michigan suppliers. Today, it's $1.8 billion a year, so a fourfold increase. And U of M economists have estimated that that's created 15,000 to 20,000 permanent jobs. So just by doing our daily investment work with Michigan companies, we can have a powerful influence. But we also are trying, Jack, to show up in our community in the right way. So Beacon Park is an example where we took a dilapidated, abandoned piece of land next to our headquarters and have turned it into a community asset. But we're working on a lot of other fronts in the community around education and youth causes and so forth that not only do I think are the responsibility of a corporation, but our people love it. Our people love to be involved in it themselves. And it makes them proud of the company. And I think when people are proud of a company, they work differently.
Jerry Anderson, speaking of being proud, your mom is up there with all the other saints in heaven. And every morning she looks down and she says, "That's my Jerry. That's my Jerry." And we're all proud of him. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.